Thank you. Good evening. In the last years, I've noticed that more Palestinians, and especially young ones, though not only, tell me in the course of a conversation, sometimes a civil conversation, sometimes more heated, that I should leave the country because I'm a settler. Not once and not twice, and I see that it is more frequent that those young people especially dare to say to me, you should return to where you came from. The Jews should return to where they came from. A neighbor told me, I think a bit oblivious of the fact that I am myself a Jew, she told me, and she quoted White House reporter Helen Thomas, who said the same, that the Jews should return to where they came from. Sometimes I argued, but less and less so. I listen, I decide to be, not to be Amira, but to be the journalist. So I write it down to myself, to pay attention, to include it in my understanding of the Palestinian scene, of the Palestinian people, of the Palestinian mood. I don't necessarily report about it, but I take this into account. At most, I don't take it personally. I live among Palestinians, so it's one of the things that some Israelis blame me for. I more and more understand and can identify with their point of view. You know, sometimes when I often go to refugee camps, and refugee camps that are, perhaps the big one will be 1 square kilometer. And the people who live there are descendants of 20 villages, 30 villages. Each village had more territory, more area than the camp itself. And I understand and I see those youngsters who live in those dense houses, that they do think about the horizons that their parents and grandparents had. Or grandparents. Maybe they sometimes romanticize. You know, each family says, or each person says, oh, my grandfather had this huge house and this huge orchard. And then if you sum it up, it would have been the size, Palestine would have been the size of the United States. But this is understandable. This is understandable because in comparison to their life now, of course, they think about the horizons, both metaphorical and real, that they lost. It's not just a matter of territory, of assets. It is a matter of the future that they could have had in the past, of a continuity with the former generations. That the presence, that the existence of Israel disrupted. And after all, this is the definition of colonialism or settler colonialism, that I live on both sides, on their side and on my side. That there is a territory where people from other countries come into and slowly or not slowly evict the indigenous population and take the land for themselves. And more than that, build a political system that completely excludes the original population. There was this guy from Jelazun camp, a very able lawyer and human rights lawyer, who told me, I don't care what the Jews who live, what the people who live now in my grandfather's house and on my family's land, what they will do. I want it back. And this sort of honesty explains why it is very difficult for me to live in Israel proper. In a way, the fact that I live in Ramallah, some people think, oh, I sacrifice a lot by living in Ramallah. But in a way, whenever I go inside Israel, I feel the Nakba, I feel the expulsion of Palestinians or the absence of Palestinians almost everywhere I go. I recognize it's those, be it the old houses, stone houses, that were built in the 20s or even before, 1920s or in the 19th century, and they radiate this kind of this natural connectedness of people to their land. Or you recognize the old trees, you see the cactus bushes, you see certain trees that you know that they are older than the state. And everywhere radiates to me that people that I know maybe from refugee camps, their grandparents planted the tree or built the house or plan to build the house. I have very good friends in Gaza from a certain village called Brer. It so happened that with time I came to know and to befriend people who are descendants of this village Brer, which is on the way to Gaza, not far from the Israeli, now Israeli, town of Sderot. And like everybody jokes in Gaza that I am considered a Brer person. And the way that the children who never saw, who never lived there, speak about their... So one always told me, we were the only ones to have a concrete house. So very proudly so. The grandfather, who was 8 or 9 years old when, or even more, during 48, remembers very accurately how they fought against the Jewish army and how they were bombed or attacked. All these stories and the knowing of the people connect me to them and make it very difficult emotionally to be in Israel. I don't say that it's easy to go through the West Bank and see all the settlements, on the contrary. Actually, since I moved to the West Bank in 97 till today, the only thing I see expanding are those settlements. It's so clear, it's so tangible, this expansion of settlements. So this continuation of a colonialist process, of a settler colonial process, is very clear, very, very vivid. But still, the people are there. The people in the West Bank are there. While in Israel proper, you feel much more the absence of the indigenous people. So what do I say as Amira? When I say, if I say something, or what do I say to you? Because after all, if I am a settler, or even a member of a settler colonial system, what are you? And that's what I told when I still answered. Another young man, a photographer who just returned from the States, he had some scholarship to go and work in the States for some time or visit. And he returned, he's from a refugee camp called El Aida. And he told me that, again, that the Jews should go back to where they came from. So I said, you returned now from the States, United States. Do you expect all the European, all the Americans of European origin to go back to Europe? Why don't you ask them to go back to Europe? What is the difference? I think he was taken aback. He didn't take this into account. For me, you know, I think that you stop seeing it. But when I go to states, such to United States, or I was in Canada, in Quebec, in Australia, I look at the architecture and I see how colonialist it is, how it is imitating Europe, imitating England. I look here and I see they had a good bargain with those British. You know, they didn't have much space in England, so here they go and they build and they sprawl like this, and they can build very nicely gridded towns. It's all very organized and orderly. I see colonialism very much wherever I am here in your country. And yes, I think that I say it in a sort of way to comfort myself. So this is the... And maybe you say about Israel that it's heterocolonial also to comfort yourselves. We are all sharing the same... We are all more or less in the same boat. I also see here, when I'm in this country, I see it very acutely, the absence of the indigenous people. It's very clear. I don't know the names. You probably know. I don't know the names of the tribes here. But this is very, very clear. Another occasion when somebody told me that Jews should go back was at a checkpoint where workers go, through which workers, Palestinian workers, go to Israel to work. And I joined them. I joined the crowd one day when there was a project or an Israeli operation, Shin Bet intelligence operation, to return permits to people whose permits had been taken for some reason or the other. So I was there about 9 or 10 hours with the workers waiting for their permits to be returned, accompanying people with their hopes and dwindling hopes, and then disappointment when they didn't get the permit back to work in Israel, or when their permit was returned, and with a joy. Anthropologically, it was very interesting. And I was talking, 9 hours, you wait for this bureaucracy to proceed, and 9 hours is a long time. And I went from one group to another, and everybody, being the only woman there within the crowd of men, they opened conversation too. And there were two guys from one of the villages whose fathers are prominent in Hamas. This I learned yet later. And one was a bit younger, one was above 30. Both spent a long time in prison, like their parents had, fathers had. And the young one says, yes, you should go away. That's the solution, no other solution. The other one, I saw he was genuinely disturbed by this. He was genuinely taken aback. So he told his friend, he said, oh no, but we acknowledge. And he said, it was kind of a slip of the tongue. He said, we acknowledge that you were the first ones to be here. So this is not what people acknowledge, but he acknowledged that, if you believe in the Quran, you accept the Jews were in this country, okay, many, many, many years ago. But you acknowledge the linkage. He acknowledged the linkage between Jews and the country. So this suggests a difference between our colonialism and your colonialism, let's say. There is a linkage. You didn't have a linkage, other than maybe, capitalist drive. Some years ago, on a Nakba day, on a demonstration of a Nakba day to commemorate the Nakba, I was walking with the people in Ramallah, and I was approached by a colleague, a journalist, a Palestinian journalist, not young, a bit younger than me, but he was then probably 45, so not, and with a background. He was in Palestinian left wing, so with some intellectual background. And he just returned from a meeting with Israeli journalists. And for that he was blamed as normalizer. I mean, that this is not... that there is a trend now not to accept such meetings. By the way, I was also invited to this meeting, but I refused because I say I don't need to meet Palestinian journalists abroad. I can meet them in the country because the meeting was abroad. But he went there, and he met some journalists that he had never met before. And he said, you know what I learned? I said, what? That Zionism, he said, Zionism is not really imperialism or colonialism. I was surprised, and I said, what do you mean? He said, you have a connection to the country. You had a religious connection to the country. in a way, it was very naive because it, in a way, extradited the efforts that are being made by many Palestinians over many generations to deny this linkage. I see it in many places. First of all, there is a legend, historian who claims that everything that is written in the Bible did not happen in Palestine, but in Saudi Arabia. So that they are... Now, in a way, this is the mirror image of the tendency, Christian-Jewish tendency, to treat the Bible as a historical document. So this is also faulty, of course. But they do the other extreme. You go, for example, to the city of Sebastia and to the ruins of Sebastia, and there is a plaque put by the PA, Palestinian Authority, and there is total no mention of the fact that this was, in that place, there was a capital of the state of Israel. I think in the 9th century BC or 8th BC, I don't remember. This denial, in a way, hints that they think that if there is a link, then Israeli or Jewish settler colonialism and the driving out of Palestinians out of the country is justified. So when you deny so strongly a fact or even a mythological fact that there were Jews, that the Jews have linkage, religious linkage to the country, it's as if you say that if they do have, as they claim, then they are justified. And we say, of course not. It's not clear? My point is not clear? If you deny so strongly something, a fact that does have also some, has been substantiated also by archaeology. Again, not as the Bible, not as one-to-one like the Bible or like Christian Zionists say or Jewish Zionists say, that everything claims that we are direct descendants of Jews who were there. But they were Jews. The Jewish people did develop in that country, in that distant country. So if you deny this so strongly, it's strange. Why should you deny that there was something like this 3,000 years ago? So maybe it means that you accept that if there is a linkage, people 3,000 years later who are Jewish have the right to come back. And I say no. It doesn't justify the expulsion. The fact that we speak a Hebrew that was developed in this country 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, doesn't mean that we have the right to expel the people who live there now, to deny their clear linkage to the place, to take away their land, to destroy their houses. It is not justified at all. I don't know if this is the reason, or I guess this is not the reason, why until the late 20s and the beginning of the 1930s, most of the Jews in the diaspora did not accept the Zionist offer to go and emigrate to Palestine. Until then, the Zionist solution of building a national home to Jews in Palestine was rejected by the majority of the Jews. The majority of the Jews in the diaspora wanted to remain in the diaspora. And like before, when they were persecuted, they sought other solutions like emigration, like assimilation. Some, and many, in certain years, many of them joined socialist and communist movements, like my parents did, believing that once we change the world, there is no need for, there will be no persecution and no anti-Semitism and no racism. Once we'll bring heaven on earth, or the socialist heaven. But emigration was and remained the most popular solution for Jews who were persecuted or who felt threatened and who were really threatened. Until 1924, and those you can attest to this, until 1924, many emigrated to the States, to the United States. Only that in 1924, the United States changed the emigration law. And emigration became more difficult for people who did not fit certain characteristics. Then the same thing was true about other places in the world who were not welcoming Jews. It became more and more acute with the rise of anti-Semitism and with the rise of Hitler and of Nazism and the advent of genocidal anti-Semitism. And yes, you mentioned the commemoration day of the Holocaust, which is tomorrow. Jews wanted to leave the country. They felt that they needed to leave, that it's too dangerous to remain. And they had many signs, they got many signs, many signals from other countries that they are not wanted. We don't know, we cannot tell how many could have been saved if they were more welcome in other countries. But the fact is that also when the few, when the survivors in 45, the survivors also confronted this refusal to accept them in mass numbers, in the States, in Canada, and more so. When they returned to their respective countries, and again I can bring my parents as an example, and those of them who did want to remain in their respective countries, my mother wanted to remain in Yugoslavia, my father wanted to remain in Romania, they discovered that they were not welcome. That those societies that they considered as their own societies, and as communists they wanted to build together in the country, to build the future Yugoslavia or the future, the new Yugoslavia or the new Romania, they discovered that they were not welcome. Somehow during the Nazi occupation, anti-Semitism, expulsionist anti-Semitism filtered or seeped in much deeper. So people found themselves looking at Palestine or the land of Israel as their resort or as their haven or as their refuge. If they thought until then that the diaspora is a natural environment for Jews or the natural place for Jews, okay, we can say, we can pray next year in Jerusalem, we can say it as something as a ritual, but we don't really mean it. But after the Second World War, many more Jews understood that the diaspora did not want them. Now, does it also justify? Of course not. One of the memories that my father shared with me for the first time, and it surprised me, about 4 days before he died, we didn't know that he would die, he had a stroke. But I came to visit him. I already lived in Ramallah, and I came to see my parents, and I had a chat with him, and he remembered how in 1950, it was only 1 year or 1 year and a half after he came to Israel as a refugee, actually. He said how he went down He went from Tel Aviv back to Jerusalem. It was a much longer trip than today. And on the sides of the road, there were the vineyards of Palestinian villages that had been emptied. And people stopped their cars or went down to collect the grapes. The grapes in summer, grapes grew, and people came to collect the grapes. And he said how ashamed he felt that people do it. It was the first time that he shared with me this memory. It told me about how he was tormented all those years. Actually, years earlier, I think it was during the first Intifada, he shared with me a dream, not a memory, but a dream. And again, like the memory, also with the dream, I feel as if I were there with him in the dream. And actually, I was, because in his dream, we were standing, and masses of people were coming down the valley, down the mountains to the valleys, thousands of people, and we held hand. He told me, probably Meidale or Amirale, something in Yiddish. He said, Meidale, they are coming back, meaning the Palestinians, and that's a dream he had during the first Intifada. Is it realizable? I don't know. But again, it shows his torment. It tells about his torment that I think that not many people like himself shared, because it's very easy to deny. It's very easy to ignore this history. But I know that still in the 50s, in the Communist Party, or at least as my father remembered, and my mother, is that there was a demand that the refugees should be allowed to come back. This was one of the demands. And the fact that Israel did not allow the refugees to come back tells how, no matter how they explained the war, how Israel explained the war, the fact that it did not allow Palestinians to return and destroy their villages, empty villages, and took over their lands, and even declared Palestinian refugees who were not in their own villages during the act of occupation of the village, but were nearby, declared them as present absentees, so they didn't have any right anymore to their own property and their own houses. So all this proved that Israel indeed continued the thread of settler colonialism. It could allow them to return. There weren't so many. It could have allowed them to return and to try and build something else, something which is not a nation, a purified nation state. It did not. At the same time, what Israel did in 49 is to accept those remaining Palestinians, I think it was around 170,000, it allowed them to become citizens. It gave citizenship. That on the nominally or officially or formally, they have civil equal rights to Jews. Of course, it is not true, but they do have a right to vote. They are part of the political system. And here there is another difference that I can tell between our colonialism and your colonialism. I guess because our colonialism is so anachronistic. It happened in the times of decolonization. And again, that's one of the reasons that I give to my suggestion, or the proof that I give to my suggestion, that without the rise of Nazism and the big success of Nazism in that sense, probably Zionism would not have succeeded in building a state in that country. because it didn't have the people who wanted to come, and the money was not enough. And also, without war, without the war inside, until 1948, the Zionist movement managed to get between 8 to 12% of the land by purchasing the land. It didn't have much of the land in Palestine. But the big difference is, thanks to this anachronism, is that the Palestinian people, there was no genocide of the Palestinian people. Unlike the genocide of the indigenous peoples in the Americas and in Australia. And this is a huge difference. This is a huge difference. When Palestinians tell me, oh, we are like the Red Indians, I say, no, this is not true. You're not like the Red Indians. The policies might, there are some policies that are very similar. Some of the practices are very similar, but you are not extinct. Now, also, the indigenous people, we know that, I learned this in Canada, that they are very, they reject this term, extinct. But still, in numbers, if we have the ratio, of course, they are just a very tiny minority in comparison to you, the settlers. While with us, the Jewish settlers and Palestinians, we are now half-half in the country. And might be very soon there will be more Palestinians than Jews in the country, though I must say that now the Orthodox Jews are changing this a bit. So the fact that we don't have genocide behind us, and that the Palestinian people, not only that they live, that it lives, but that there are many and more, in a strange way, when they say that Jews should leave the country, it is more feasible. It is not feasible when an indigenous person here in America tells you you should leave, or you should go back, you should go on the boats that brought you here and go back, as I heard some people saying half mockingly. When they say it, you know very well that this is impossible. When Palestinians tell it, and I say it, and I must say that I heard it also from a Palestinian, when they say it, there is a possibility. It is not totally impossible. But if it happens, or if this is a goal, and some Palestinians do entertain it as a goal, let me be frank. I just gave a talk in Chicago University, and there was a young Palestinian woman. It was a talk in the Arab American Cultural Center. And a young woman came to me after my talk, and she said, yes, that there is a friend who tells her that the Jews should leave. And she said, many, many say so. So I'm not inventing. There is a dream to undo history. There is a dream to reverse, to go back, to say that, okay, Jews will be admitted here, at best case, as individuals or as a religious denomination, not as a people. This exists, and I hear it. I live in among Palestinians, and I hear it also. What it entails that in order to achieve this, we have to rely on a war, on a big war between the two sides. And Palestinians do keep saying something that they heard from Jamal Abdel Nasser long ago, that what was taken by force will be taken back by force. So there is this kind of romanticism about the armed struggle. And I see one of my, how would I say, really goals when I speak to Palestinians is to try to dissuade them from this, how shall I call it, a dream or a hallucination that they can solve things by a war. Because a war will only aggravate. And if will be forced, if Jews will be forced to leave, or will leave, it'll be also at the expense of the Palestinians. I mean, the devastation of the Palestinians will be even worse than this of the Jews in the country. And this is the tragedy that, I mean, part of the tragedy, that we cannot undo history. Sometimes I do wish that, sometimes I do say, and I say it when I realize, or when I get more and more proofs how Israel continues its settler colonialism, how it continues till today and uses practices and perfects practices of evicting Palestinians from their land and using them those tricks today in the West Bank. So I say, I wish that America gave us all the green card. Let 5 million Jews... You will not feel us right here if we are... 5 million, what is it, 5 million? So once I said it to two brother and sister, Jewish brother and sister from New York, and the brother said, they are lawyers, and the brother said, no, 5 million is too much. Let some go to Australia. So... And then we'll be settlers in Australia too. I say it because, indeed, in 93, Israel got a real, very generous present from the Palestinians, from the PLO headed by Arafat. When they accepted the two-state solution, when they accepted to establish a state in Gaza and the West Bank only, which is 23% of historical Palestine. They gave us, it was really generous. It was a message that they understand that, yes, it is painful because they all feel the belonging to the entire country, but that for the sake of the future generations and for the sake of other ways to develop, not just territorial, we need to stop the war. We need to stop the danger of permanent war. And I truly believe that Arafat, even though I have many issues with this man, he really believed, like some others, that it has to come to an end. Also because history doesn't have final phases. When PLO spoke about gradual or in steps, it is logical because there is never a stagnant stage from which you do not proceed. So who knows if we had a state in Gaza and West Bank, according to the principles or the guidelines that we had in the Israeli left-wing camp in the 70s, full Israeli withdrawal, no settlement, is Jerusalem is the capital. Recognition of the responsibility of Israel to the Nakba in 1948. Then there would have been good relationship between the two countries, between the two states. Exchange of trade, exchange of students, exchange of visits. There would be tourism. Maybe the logic of nation state, purified nation state, could have been eroded slowly, not immediately. But look at Europe today. Okay, maybe today Europe is not such a good example, but at least it was for some time. And still, you know, relations between France and Germany, or England and France, nothing is final in history. And this could have been a good... But I think that this is exactly why Israel did everything possible since 93. To foil this possibility of a Palestinian state. Now there is a fashion among radicals to say that the two-state solution is a Zionist solution. So I want them to explain to me, if it is so, why Israel indeed did all its efforts in tandem with the peace, with the negotiation process, did everything in order to make it impossible. The establishment of a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank. And this was done, which is obvious, which is clear to all, the establishment of Israeli settlements or the expansion of Israeli settlements, and the permanent land grab. Every day there is a new trick. Every day there is a new piece of land that the Israeli army confiscates for this reason or another reason. As a journalist, I follow it on a regular basis. The water that is allocated to the Palestinians is much less than this allocated to Israelis and settlers. The separation of Palestinians from each other, the separation wall, does not separate so much Palestinians from Israelis. They were separated anyway before. It separates Palestinians from Palestinians and Palestinians from their land and a Palestinian village from another Palestinian village. Gaza was totally cut out long before the suicide attacks, so it cannot be a pretext when we say that Gaza was, that people from Gaza could not leave Gaza. It started before. It was not a punishment or a deterrence, but it was before. This continuity of Israel settler colonialism without being abated by the international community is indeed frightening, because we can see, as we see here, that settler colonialism does succeed. There is a growing fear right now that groups in Israel that advocate mass expulsion. Again, mass expulsion, those groups are getting stronger. And this should alarm everybody. Those groups are messianic, religious, right-wing. They are in the parliament, they are out of the parliament. They are scholars, lawyers, very educated people, educators. These people openly or with hints, many of them are rabbis, say something like, Arabs should thank us that we allow them to be here. The threat, the hidden threat here is very clear. Some advocate expulsion of families of a person who perpetuated a killing of an Israeli. They say this is the right kind of punishment. Prison is not enough. Demolition of a house is not enough. We should expel the whole family. You hear members of parliament who say that Arabs should declare loyalty to the state of Israel, and only on that condition they could remain. If not, that they should leave or be expelled. And this is not seen anymore as a marginal fantasy of some weirdos, as maybe it was seen 30 years ago, like Rabbi Kahana. Rabbi Kahana was declared illegal in Israel 30 years ago. Likud party completely dissociated itself from Rabbi Kahana. Today, they have people who talk like him in the coalition or in the parties which are close to Likud. So Israeli settler colonialism today might, if not stopped or if not challenged by the international community, can push things towards a new mass expulsion. Personally, this haunts me. This fear haunts me. And again, I will say what I already said several times this week. I do not prophesize. It's not a prophecy. It's a warning. It is preventable. It is something that can be stopped. And there are forces in the Israeli and the Palestinian society, forces that can prevent it from happening. Even economical forces in Israel, the Palestinians in Israel, are part of the Israeli economy. Yes, they are discriminated against, but they are part of the Israeli economy. And Palestinians, aware of 1948 more than ever, promise not to leave. So it is not, it's not that I am seeing, you know, that I have a crystal ball and I see this, the future. But I want to warn and to ring the alarm. If I'm asking you for anything, is to speak out about this danger and make people aware of it so that it cannot happen. Thank you. I don't know if you heard the same talk that I was giving. I'm sorry. I don't come to tell you what you think you know. I come to tell people maybe what they don't want to hear. And I'm sure that you don't want to hear that you live in a settler colonial country too.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, all right, okay. So, please.
You never mentioned the word of apartheid. Israel is a criminal state of apartheid, killing, torturing, imprisoning poor, defenseless Palestinians. What is, and then you are worried about, the olive trees are cut. Every, look at this, no water, no electricity, no, it's just unbelievable.
And look, if you know all this, why do you want me to tell you?
No, I didn't want you to tell
no.
you.
No, I want...
First hand,
okay. I'm sorry. I think that you didn't hear me. I'm sorry. When I'm talking about expulsion of Palestinians, do you want to tell me that I... come on, I mean, I don't have to explain my talk. I'm sorry. If you want slogans, then don't come to listen to me. If you want slogans, don't come to listen to me.
What are the stories that you don't tell about, and why?
Oof. Okay, let me take some questions and then I will answer, okay?
Yeah. Another one here. Yes.
With all due respect, I was a little confused myself because you opened up with young Palestinians are telling you to leave. And then you kind of, and again, with all due respect, I actually mentioned there was someone in 2011. So, you know, But I was a little confused because you it was as if you were kind of like going through some white guilt, and it was almost sort of there was a degree of arrogance the way you described. I mean, the way you threw out settler, or my ancestors didn't settle anybody. We were brought here.
with people who want to see liberated people in Palestine and Israel. What would you say to people who want to work towards that and along with BDS?
Okay. What don't I tell? First of all, there is, you don't tell things because you don't have the space and the time to work on every story, on everything. Somebody asked me just in one of the other talks whether there was an Israeli ban on going to Hebron because this person noticed that I didn't mention anything about Israel dispersing Palestinian students in Old Hebron or throwing tear gas at people in at students in Hebron. And I said, no, there is no ban. I just didn't have the... I cannot cover everything that is happening. So this is one... I can say that usually what I don't tell, and this will probably annoy again the lady here and maybe others, is that when Palestinians say things that are unpleasant, I don't report about it. I once interviewed a businessman, actually millionaire, who said that the Jews control the banks. So I did not include this in my report. Because I know, because the Israelis will use it, they will not listen to the content of what he says about the situation and about Israeli control, and they say, well, he's this and that or this and that. So I refrain from reporting. I was just now with some Palestinian students telling them about another example, and I will, similar to this, that I prefer not to report about when it comes to the choice. I mean, not because of time, but because of choice. I indeed ask myself, what do I do with issues that concern Palestinians, Palestinian internal issues, like patriarchy? To what extent should I cover Palestinian patriarchy? Attitudes towards women, bad attitudes, laws. What? There are cases of murder of women. Is this for me to report about or not? There was, when 3 years ago, then when the phenomenon of young people going with knives and trying to stab an Israeli soldier, usually still Israelis with uniforms. Also women joined in, but women were waving with knives and shot dead or wounded severely. And they were acclaimed in the Palestinian press as heroes. But actually, since I go to their, when they are wounded or they are arrested, and you hear and you know that men, the great majority of women, in these cases, fled home because of domestic violence of sorts. And this is a known secret that the Palestinians 3 years ago still did not write about it. Is it my role as an Israeli journalist to write about it or not? And there is a... I don't think that you understand the role of journalism, I'm sorry. And this is a question that I ask myself. So my criteria was, once Palestinians start to talk about it, I can continue or I can relate to it. Of course, with very little details. I cannot share all the details that I know. But this is something that Palestinian society, I think it's one of the mistakes not to discuss it openly, that they have those women, and that there is a serious problem of women who run away from their homes, and use this like the suicide by cop, use this as a way, and it's tragic. This is a question. The same thing about young people. We know about villages that have conducted demonstrations, weekly demonstrations against the occupation. But there are kids who joined in, and I heard it again, from fathers and from people in the villages, that they discovered that the children join in as a way to, for example, to be in prison, and that's where they can do the exams, the final exams, more easily. So do I write about it or don't I write about it? This is a question. Do I want to please? Do I write because I want to please? Do I talk because I want to please people, certain people? Or do I want to write and to say things because information and knowledge are a very, very important tools in our fight for a change? I think that sloganeering doesn't bring us anywhere. Sloganeering. And repetition like parrots, the same slogans that you could hear from everybody, doesn't bring us anywhere. It was said to you, and you could read me, and you know what I read to the Israeli people. Here I'm talking to the choir. Will it help you if I said, Israel is Nazi, Israel is racist, Israel is this? I mean, you can judge by what I've been writing. And I think that in every sentence that I said, and I wanted to show you the complexity, is not because I do not care if what I said can be interpreted as a way to hide facts, then I think that we are in a very serious problem, that we cannot take the complexities or the layers. A new Palestinian leadership. What Fatah and PLO organizations have managed to do is to completely paralyze the advent of any possible new leadership. They have, you know, I have nothing, being myself 63 years old, I of course have nothing against people who are older than 30 or 40. But the way that the whole Palestinian leadership is people who are quite advanced in age and don't have much relation to the generations of today, and that there are no new generations or hardly any new generations. It's very alarming, if just for this. Hamas, by the way, is in that sense much more modern a party than Fatah. People say that Fatah, oh yes, because Israel assassinated so many leaders of Fatah or would-be leaders. But Israel did the same to Hamas. And yet Hamas has this continuity and is able to give room to new generations and to newcomers and to new activists to become spokespersons or leaders. Hamas is not concentrated around a personality, while Fatah was. So that's why they are lost today. Abbas holds all the power in his hands, while in Hamas you have a joint leadership of Hamas, no matter what we think about Hamas. But Hamas are confined in the Gaza Strip. They want to represent the entire Palestinian people. They are working towards this. I think that they use, in a clever way, they use both the militarization on the one hand and the indirect talks with Israel on the other hand, in order to consolidate their basis in the Gaza Strip, and they aspire to represent the entire people. But as a religious party or a religious political party, I'm not sure they can do it for very long. They do it now, but it creates also tensions within the Palestinian society. If you get your authority, you feel you are a sovereign because God's promise or because God's your relationship with God, then at the end it is destructive to the possibilities of building a political system. Also, I think that the message of Hamas is not is conflicting. Sometimes they say that they accept the reality of the existence of Israel, even though they do not recognize the state of Israel, but they accept the reality. And sometimes they say that the goal is the liberation of entire Palestine. What I understand, and it'll take several more years for a new leadership to be built, Palestinian leadership, and I think it will be outside of the existing parties, outside of PLO, and it will be much more diverse. It will have to include Palestinians from all areas of Palestinians' life now, from inside Israel, the occupied territory, 67 occupied territory, and the diaspora. And probably the leadership, the new leadership, will have to be again in the diaspora, because inside the Israeli repression is so harsh that you cannot, they don't really allow for new leaderships to rise. There is too much pressure on them. When Hamas went to the elections in 2006 with a different name, among their principles, there was no armed struggle, which was associated naturally with Hamas until then. Now, the world, instead of accepting the democratic decision of the Palestinian people, they voted for Hamas a lot as a protest vote against Fatah. So instead of accepting this and engaging with Hamas, which would have allowed different forces within Hamas, which are more pragmatic, I would say. So instead, they pushed them to the corner by boycotting them. They pushed them to the corner, and actually they signaled to the Palestinian people that democratic process is allowed only if they do what the West wants them to do. So this absurd, under this absurd, there is no possibility for a real Palestinian new leadership to grow under the direct domination of Israel. What will I tell to people here? Yeah, I'm asked these questions quite a lot, and I'm a bit... I don't know enough. First of all, I recommend that each one of you tries to bring... to organize tours, as long as it is possible, as long as Israel does not ban any visitors who are not ardent Christian Zionists, or as long as it doesn't oblige you to sign that you are an ardent Zionist or whatever. Come and show people, your peers in professions, in schools, in universities, neighbors, whatever, small tours without much fanfare, just to see the reality, because it explains much more than any words or films or articles. And you can see how obscene it is. You can see how this reality of Israeli bantustans, of Israeli checkpoints, of fragmentation of the West Bank, how it is obscene. This is one thing that I recommend. Another thing maybe is, you know, you can adopt, I know that some are doing this, but adopt a struggle. Adopt a mini cause in the big cause. Something which is with details, not abstract or generalized slogans, but a village, for example, the water. Israel, as a policy, deprives Palestinians of equal access to water by many ways. Take the issue of water, I don't know, in your churches, in your community center, whatever. Tell people about Israeli policies over water. And go and adopt a village, a Palestinian community that has no access to water, while a nearby settlement has free water all the time. For example, write about them, visit this village, write to your representatives in Congress, make noise around this issue.
Yeah, we have one specialist issue here this evening dealing with the issue of children, the Israeli military detention of children. If I could just follow up on that, because I think that activists here have been for years now promoting the two-state solution. Jeff Albert came through here back last winter, coming out of the group that's been convening in England, saying that the two-state solution is dead. Do we need to abandon that as activists in America and talk more about the one-state solution?
When people say that the two-state solution is dead, they actually mean that the settlements are irreversible. That's what they mean. And I think that politically it is a very dangerous statement. Very dangerous. Because still, according to international law, settlements are illegal. And this is a very important tool that we have. And by saying that the settlements are irreversible, we actually say a very racist, it is a very racist claim that we know that every settlement causes terrible damage, physical and emotional and psychological harm to every Palestinian. Every settlement is not only taking land right now, not only took land yesterday, but is built on the assumption that it will get more and more land of a nearby village or a nearby Palestinian town or of anybody or of a person or a municipal council, Palestinian municipal council. So every settlement is a danger to its environment, Palestinian environment. More than that, every settlement breeds a lot of violence, both physical violence of settlers and bureaucratic violence of Israel. Decrees and more decrees that confine Palestinians to their area so that they don't get near to the Palestinians. So when we say actually, yes, it is irreversible and you can continue to do so because we cannot tell Jews to go back to their state, to stop being criminals according to international law. We cannot touch them. We can only harm the Palestinians. I think that politically this is a very dangerous message. It is legitimizing the settlements. It does not. We are not in the stage where settlers say, "Oh yes, we acknowledge that we have done a lot of harm, and let us live happily together ever after." It's not like that. The settlers are there in order to continue the drive, the colonial drive, and the expulsion of Palestinians. So I suggest not to connect the question of the one state or two states with the issue of the settlements. If we want one state, it's because we think it is possible that the two states are ready to live together. I personally do not see it. But we should not give up on the demand to dismantle the settlements as a fundamental condition for the negotiations. Then there might be some specifics, but we have to build on creating leverage, political leverage, and this does not contribute to political leverage when we actually accept that this is irreversible, that the settlements are irreversible. You know, it looks a lot. It looks, you know, there are about 600,000 or maybe, let's say, 700,000 settlers now, including 200,000 in East Jerusalem. It's a lot compared to what it was in the 70s and what it is and what it was in 91. But still, it is about 10% only of the entire Jewish population in the country. So out, in spite of all the subsidies and the governmental official encouragement for Israeli Jews to settle in the occupied territory, only 10% of the Jewish population, around 6 million, only 10% are in the settlements. It tells something. It tells that this project has not been so successful as they want to portray it. So this is my suggestion as for political tool. Don't give up on this demand that settlements are illegal and therefore should be dismantled.
We're from a human rights activists in Israel that have activists, human rights watch. He was supposed to be deported. I don't know if that's actually occurred yet. And I don't know if the revisions of the basic law have had anything to do with that. And then also, given your very rich experience in Gaza, I'd be very interested in your perspective on the UN report that was done about 5 years ago that said it will be virtually uninhabitable by 2020, which is just around the corner, and what that may mean in terms of complications in the area. And thank you very much for being here.
Okay. We'll take several.
What do you see now from the Palestinian aspect and also from the Israeli aspect, where the work has been done where the root cause of gas is sort of which builds the relationship, the relationship.
I didn't get the question. I mean, it's
the root to the groundwork that is being done, whether in the Palestinian side, like in their form from Ramallah, or any of the Israeli side that we visit, where we can.
Would you be trying to go back to the table for book signing?
All right.
So if you'll take these questions,
Omar Shaker, the representative of Human Rights Watch in Palestine, Israel, indeed. The Ministry of Interior decided not to grant him visa. Then there was some legal course, and a judge accepted the Israeli decision and did not endorsed it. So now they are going to High Court. So he is now still in the country. But there has to be a hearing at High Court, and we cannot know what High Court will say because High Court has changed over the years, is more afraid of the politicians than it used to be. Though I must say that High Court never really, unlike its reputation, always when it comes to the occupation and to the expropriation of Palestinian land, it never seriously challenged Israeli policies. So this remains to be seen, what happens with Omar Shaker. You know, Israel, in some parts, joins the company of others. As Omar himself said, he was banned from Egypt. He was banned from Syria. He might be banned if he did the same in Russia. So Israel, which portrays itself as the only democracy, etc., is acting like other countries in its intolerance of criticism, and they find all kind of loopholes to justify it. Still, I must say, and I keep repeating it, at the same time, we Israeli Jewish citizens, but also Palestinian citizens, we do have room for our criticism, Jews more than Palestinian citizens, but still, and we can still operate. So, again, I don't have this crystal ball and I to tell you whether it will stop. I don't know. We have to continue. But and there are others who do come and others who do act. And Human Rights Watch can do the same job while Omar Shaker is not there. They can employ an Israeli citizen. So there are ways, in terms of this, there are ways to compensate. And I think that Israel loses when they, or I wish, or I would have liked to say that Israel loses, because we are in a world that is changing. And we are in a world that accepts such mannerism or such acts with more tolerance than maybe 20 years ago. Hungary is different, and, you know, there are changes. Now Gaza, yeah, this is a human-made catastrophe, for sure. And I think that in many ways it has passed the 2020 threshold. It is unlivable, and I have been barred from entering there for very long, but I'm always wondering from my friends, from what I know from my friends who live there, I'm always astonished that they continue to... not only that they continue to live there, but they continue to lead life which is very dignified. A friend who was just nominated as vice principal of his school, another friend who is leading a research, a third one who sends his daughter to ride horses, painters that you have in Gaza, musicians, farmers who, in spite of all the Israeli repression and then continue to farm the land. So you do have life, and I just don't understand how this is happening. And sense of humor. Diplomats, for example, resonate what I felt in 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I first entered Gaza. They say that it's much more, diplomats who live or work in the West Bank, they say that they prefer to go to Gaza because the society is so welcoming. And when they work on a project, it is much easier to work on a project for example, infrastructure project. They feel a lot of dedication on the part of the employees. Some of them are, of course, Hamas employees, than they feel in the West Bank. Because the West Bank is still, let me say it in a positive way, Gaza has grown up to be a community, not a cluster of several big families only, though it exists, but as a community, more or less homogenized, more than the West Bank. There have to happen radical changes, and this is what I have been advocating for years already, without recovering the right of Palestinians in Gaza to freedom of movement, nothing can change. All depends on it. The high unemployment is related to the fact that they cannot leave, that they cannot work, that they cannot export, that they cannot import what they need. So this has to change dramatically. I know many young people who emigrated or actually fled from Gaza, not because they don't want to stay in Gaza, but the fact that that Gaza is a prison forces them out. If it were open, they would have gone out, worked a year or two, and returned. Or they would have worked in the West Bank and come back in the weekends. It's 70 kilometers distance. I'm appalled by how the international community saw and accompany this deterioration, which is human-made, Israel-made deterioration of the environment, of the health conditions, without doing anything. They poured money on Gaza, but it is hush money. It is hush money that covers for the political impotence. And I don't have any optimistic words here to say. How the ways to prevent expulsion? First, to talk about the danger, to highlight what those Israelis, rabbis, how they talk about expulsion, how they talk about Palestinians as redundant, as this has to be talked. This has been Jewish community here, the Jewish community here in the United States has to be exposed with those tendencies and confronted more and more so. I do not expect anything of your administration, your present administration. But there is a difference, there is a difference between the people and the administration. And these issues have to be raised more. This is also up to you to find ways. There are enough Israelis who write down claims, such statements, such racist statements, and expulsionist calls by Israeli, by prominent Israeli Jews, that can be that can be brought here and documented. Pressure on your, I think the most, I mean, has to come. It has to be very clear that neighboring states, Arab states, will resist any such Israeli attempt. That's why, and it's a pity that this lady is not here, that's why war is so frightening. Because the war enables expulsion. I have to say that I'm shocked by how it was misunderstood. But I can analyze it. I can analyze it politically. I can analyze why a person who lives here doesn't like to hear such things. But a war, that's why right-wingers all the time push for wars. All the time. Because wars can enable, like 48, 49, like the war, the Second World War, wars enable to perpetuate plans that it's impossible to do in, it's not peace times, but in other times. I heard settlers when there was the war against Iraq in 2003, they were encouraging this to happen because of the possibility that if Jordan is involved or some others are involved and Palestinians may be engaged or something, we'll have more tools to or pretext to kick them out. The right wing was in favor of war on Gaza too. Because if there is a war on Gaza, there might be agitation in the West Bank. There might be some acts or so. And then, so I think the prevention of war is not, how would I say, a softy attitude. Or a softy political attitude, or a defeatist attitude. Not at all. You know, I don't remember Howard Zinn, I don't remember now if he called me or sent me an email. I think, you know, it's like it was in the middle of the second intifada, and I had the honor of being contacted by Howard Zinn. And he told me we want to, I think it was by phone, I would have kept the email. He said, we want to have a petition calling the world to act to prevent wars. And I kind of grinned, and he said, yes, yes, I know it sounds very fantastic, but we have to acknowledge the danger of wars because of this expulsion. So, not only, but the danger of expulsion becomes only the more concrete during wars. And then we can think together what other means to make it preventable. But first of all, to acknowledge that this is a danger. Israelis indeed live. I think less than the legend tells. There are Israelis in Berlin, for example, which is a very, you know, it is a very interesting twist of history. They do live, but at the same time, they keep their privileges in Israel. They don't give up on their citizenship. They have their property. They can return to Israel any moment. They didn't give up their house or land to the Palestinian family who used to live there before. They can come to the country to vote when there are elections. You know that the Israeli right wing wants to grant the right for Israelis who are abroad to vote, assuming that the majority, especially in the United States, assuming that the majority are going to vote for right-wing parties. So it's not such a glick, you know. If it's not that Israel is going to be emptied soon of all its Israeli Jewish citizens.
Thank you.